Hello, welcome to our Clivatrans webinar today, and thank you for attending. Good afternoon to those of you who are in the UK and Europe, and good morning if you're joining us from the US. And happy Chinese New Year for our clients and colleagues who are joining us from Asia. And just for those in Asia, we'll actually be running a separate webinar in the next few weeks, specifically for the APAC region. But anybody else is welcome to join that second invitation, second session. My name is Paul Landis, and I'm lucky today to be joined by my colleagues, Jesse Overall, Steve Gatty, and Cliff Cohn, who are based in New York and Washington and focus on the digital assets and regulatory space, and are very busy watching the last sort of whirlwind round of developments, where today we're going to be covering what's happening with Trump 2.0 and what to expect with digital assets legislation and regulation and the use of DLT more broadly in the financial services sector, which has been held back by a lot of regulatory and legal confusion and disagreement and debate. We'll talk about the first week, the week so far, but also key developments to come. And I'm looking forward to hearing some predictions and some thoughts as to their own crystal balls for the future. A couple of housekeeping items for those on the call now. This is going to be a 30-minute session. It's being recorded, so do forward on the recording to colleagues who haven't been able to join. We've disabled the chat feature, but if you do have any questions, feel free to reach out to us, and we can follow up with you separately. So let's start. So week one of the new administration, it's been quite a whirlwind, as I say. And Jesse, Steve, Cliff, you must be exhausted running around, following everything. We know that the crypto space is one area, and this was clearly an issue on the Trump campaign that Trump wanted to address and really take on with some real change. And we've seen a lot of first moves that are showing that this is a key area of change and a real priority for the Trump 2.0 government. But can you just give us a summary of where we got to? Jesse, perhaps you can go first, and I'll pass the call around. Jesse.
Of course, and thank you so much, Paul. And it's an honor to be here and be joined by so many of our esteemed colleagues and clients and friends, discussing these issues relating to the fintech sector and crypto and how it's all going to shake out. And it's as anticipated, the Trump administration has made fintech and the fintech sector a priority. And in the flurry of executive actions in the president's first week, you saw the executive order on strengthening American leadership in digital financial technology, which, as we kind of unpack the different strands there, I think there's a lot of areas which the industry has been focused on for quite a while. And I think that, in emphasizing that it's the policy of the administration, to encourage the development of technology neutral regulatory frameworks that take account of emerging technologies, the policy of the administration in respect of basically debanking, so free and open access to the banking system for lawful businesses. And things like the ability to transact on public, permissionless open blockchain networks, mining and validation, self-custody, things of that nature. I think a lot of things that, practitioners and industry market participants have been focused on for a while. I think a number of these themes, found were expressed in the executive order. I think that another important element of it is the creation of a working group led by the president's point person on crypto and AI, and consisting of the heads of certain of the agencies, including the Treasury and the two federal markets regulators, but interestingly, not including any of the federal banking regulators. Tasked with delivering reports on digital assets and the basically new regulations and existing regulations that apply to them, and how they can be sort of adapted to the policies expressed in the executive order. I think also CBDC is another major, area here. Not surprisingly, given, the president's comments in the Bitcoin Nashville conference, it does look like CBDC development is prohibited by the executive branch agencies acting on their own, quote unquote, unelected bureaucrats. But I think that, one thing that's been underappreciated in the commentary is the beginning of the sentence, except as provided by law, which I think kicks the issue over to Congress, which is, now controlled by the president's party. And I think if you look at, the majority whip in the House of Representatives and the current vice chair, chairman of the Subcommittee on Digital Assets and the House Financial Services Committee, that being Representative Emmer from Minnesota, Representative Emmer introduced a bill in the Stop CBDC Surveillance Act or something along those lines in May 2024. And if you actually look at Representative Emmer's bill from early in 2024, you'll actually see that the way they defined CBDC was a retail CBDC. And actually, it wouldn't have touched wholesale CBDC. So I think that's an area that's been underappreciated in the commentary is the extent to which this issue has been kicked to Congress. And I think if you look at the way that, Congress might kind of shape that policy, if there's a little more nuance there than just saying all CBDCs are prohibited. But maybe I can pass the other developments on to my colleagues.
Yeah, Steve, I don't know what your sort of thoughts are over the last week or so. It's all been quite breathtaking. Anything to add?
Sure. Well, I mean, one big development I'm sure folks have followed or seen, and we actually just wrote about it, should be published today, was the SEC rescinding staff accounting bulletin.
I think it's all over everybody's emails. I mean, that's really been dominating a lot of the airways over the last few days for a lot of people. The SCB 122.
Yeah, exactly. And it was anticipated. As folks may know, there was a House passed a resolution last year to rescind it, which was overridden by a veto by President Biden. But, essentially what we think the biggest developments associated with 122 is it will open up the ability of, traditional custodians and really infrastructure players within the financial markets to, offer kind of crypto-related services around custody, which should drive greater institutionalization of these markets and greater adoption, by investment management firms or otherwise in terms of allocations to these assets. Sorry, Paul.
That's great. And I don't know, Cliff, have you got any other?
And yeah, I'm back to the list.
The only thing I wanted to add is just taking it back to the executive order and the working group established by the president.
Right.
It's kind of buried in the text, but the executive order requires within 180 days that working group come back with recommended regulatory and legislative proposals around providing regulatory clarity at a federal regulatory framework for digital assets, which would include stablecoins. And that is fairly, the government, the U.S. government, isn't known for moving with, deliberate speed. So 180 days is a fairly quick turnaround.
That's pretty fast. Yeah.
Come up with some recommendations for comprehensive legislation here. But I think that's really the goal is to, around the market structure of these assets, clearly define what constitutes a security, what's a commodity, what's a digital asset or collectible, and then move something forward to give, the industry the regulatory clarity it's been desperate for years.
Yeah. And some of that lack of clarity has just been the SEC's activity. We've all been overwhelmed watching all the SEC activity and statements from Gensler and all the enforcement action. Can we...
I don't know.
let's chat more about
all the cases. I mean, what's going to happen now with all the cases so far? What's the state of play with all of the enforcement? What's going to happen next now? I don't know, Steve, do you have any thoughts around that?
Yeah, sure. Take it forward. Yeah, I mean, well, you know, the cases, I think there was this initial rush of folks believing that, you know, as soon as a change in administration, a number of cases would be stayed or, you know, revisited by the SEC and not kind of continue unabated. That may still happen, but I think that's unlikely in the short term. Although I would recommend folks read Commissioner Peirce's speech yesterday at Northwestern University, where she gives a broad roadmap of her views of enforcement outside of, you know, it's not focused on digital assets, but is an excellent perspective on her view. And go back and read Paul Atkins' dissents from his tenure will give you a good idea. But, you know, the developments in the cases, the big cases continue unabated. You know, recently a judge in the Second Circuit granted Coinbase's motion to what's called interlocutory appeal, kind of within the case appeal to the Second Circuit on how we test applies to crypto. That is, you know, that is the sine qua non of the debate, and it'd be good to have a Second Circuit as opposed to various district courts weigh in on those issues. You know, similarly, the Third Circuit, around that struck down the SEC's explanation of its decision to deny Coinbase's petition for rulemaking. Multiple petitions by Coinbase for rulemaking over time as arbitrary and capricious. But so those will be very important decisions because, again, we're now at in very important circuits in the Second and Third Circuit. Just other kind of things that will impact digital assets enforcement. SEC has signaled that, you know, Wells meetings should be back on. It's consistent with their outpouring of desire for engagement with the industry. And I think more generally what we'll see is, and whether it's in digital assets or otherwise, an SEC return to looking at where there's fraud as opposed to kind of macro questions that should be settled more by legislation or rulemaking or industry engagement.
Okay, Steve, one quick point. Do you want to spend a minute explaining why, you know, the engagement with the Wells process is so critical to a well-functioning enforcement division? I think that's been missing for years now.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, everyone talks about getting a Wells notice and preparing a Wells, but the reality is the Wells process is a number of kind of pause points in an enforcement investigation to get more senior staff within the room at the SEC to have important discussions about the case, the strength of the SEC's case, you know, the nature of the claims. And without that, you have this kind of gun to your head, which is what we've seen over the last couple of years across the board of a lack of engagement and then a springing on you of a Wells notice, which is essentially an announcement that the enforcement division is going to recommend to the commission that they sue the firm. And with this last commission, that was basically a rubber stamp. So that's very critical. And I will say just one little footnote before turning back over to Jess and Cliff. I recently met with senior staff from the remaining commissioners. And I will tell you, all kinds of good stuff came out of that. But the biggest takeaway was a desire that they're, you know, fully committed to industry engagement and, you know, to fostering a more reasonable regulatory environment for digital assets and blockchain. There was discussion around if you have dealt with a division over the last couple of years and it didn't get anywhere, you know, bring it back again if it's still important for you. And we want to engage. So I thought that was a great point.
Okay, well, I mean, that's all good mood music for everybody. And I don't know whether Jesse or Cliff wanted anything around enforcement activity. I mean, I'm certainly conscious that Elon's looking to, you know, cut budgets and keep an eye on how different agencies are spending their money and their resources. I don't know, Jesse or Cliff, you had anything to add around the enforcement so far and what to expect from the SEC?
Well, the with the question of the securities characterization of these assets, I mean, Cliff, if we have a more, you know, if we have a shift in the way the SEC takes what sort of the enforcement heavy kind of approach, where it's there's a lot of uncertainty around whether assets are securities or not. I mean, do you think we could see developments with respect to ETFs and similar pooled investment products?
I mean, I certainly hope so. I mean, I think the outgoing or the former administration, their approach to all of this was, you know, let's shoot first, ask questions later. And in a really kind of cynical way, you know, going after digital asset providers and innovators and are essentially saying, we're going to shoehorn what you're doing into the Securities Act of 1933, even though that act, you know, is blissfully unaware of the changes in the world and the nature of digital assets. And it just became, you know, a way to just kind of stifle innovation, you know, enforce regulation through enforcement. And it spooked a lot of people. We had a lot of innovation move offshore. We had a lot of clients say to us, you know, we'd love to do this, but we need to set it up somewhere other than the United States. And, you know, people forget that the SEC has a three-part mission, you know, protecting investors, maintaining orderly and efficient markets, and facilitating capital formation. You know, there wasn't much facilitation of capital formation under the Gensler SEC. And so, you know, I think we're going to see an SEC that, you know, there have been a lot of good ideas. Maybe we provide a safe harbor for digital assets for some period of time before we need to make a determination as to whether or not they're securities. Maybe the working group comes back with something comprehensive and workable. But I certainly think that, you know, we're already seeing a different approach with the SEC, more engagement on registration statements that, you know, would have been completely ignored, or you would have received a request from the SEC staff to withdraw it altogether. That seems to have changed almost overnight.
And I don't know, Jesse, what do you think? Because certainly from here, it's always been the view that, you know, there's been a lot of TradFi and wider effort around trying to deploy blockchain technology into, you know, market operations, or looking at, you know, wider tokenization, even around digital bonds. You know, there's been so much excitement in Europe, in the UK, well, in Asia and Switzerland around that space, that the people have felt that SEC behavior has really held back, not only the product development that Cliff touched on, but just wider operational and wider infrastructure developments. I don't know, Jesse, what do you think about how the SEC's change is going to help all this?
Yeah, I mean, I think that with the rescission of SAB 121 and, you know, the restoration of sort of a, you know, the traditional reference to GAAP, right, with respect to the way that, for instance, you account for these assets. If you're a public reporting company, like many traditional financial institutions are, and, you know, obviously SAB 121 was kind of notable for its non-technology neutral approach, which in actually, you know, I believe, and many critics believe, you know, in contrast to what, you know, GAAP requires, I mean, including but not limited to things like ASC 860, for instance, you know, and requiring custodians to recognize an asset on their own balance sheet in relation to a customer custodial crypto asset, and then recognize a corresponding liability again on the custodian's own balance sheet automatically and without any regard for the probability or the likelihood of loss by the custodian of that asset, to automatically have to recognize the liability. I mean, that was something which, you know, interfered with long-held notions in, you know, the banking industry and among, I guess, the TradFi world for, you know, most asset classes, where assets held in connection with certain safeguards and certain, you know, regimes, I mean, absent very special circumstances, you know, they were held off balance sheet by the custodian. And so, you know, I mean, with SAB 121 now gone, and of course, that triggered a cascade then of concerns relating to concerns relating to, first of all, bankruptcy remoteness, and secondly, capital ratios, right? And that's something that was causing a number of traditional custodians to sort of hold back from basically engaging with digital assets, both on the crypto side, and then because of the uncertainty that the broad definitions created, which are not necessarily unsolvable. And at the tail end of the Biden administration, the SEC actually did release no objection, semi-staff guidance, and it mainly applied to kind of existing already regulated financial institutions.
Can we chat about some of the other regulators? We've talked a lot about the SEC and the securities regulatory side. Can we talk about the CFTC? I mean, one of the questions that came into me the other day is, are we going to see the SEC and the CFTC merge? There's been this kind of never-ending debate, but might this be the moment? We've got Elon there. We've got a Trump-dominated Congress. I don't know. It'd be good to get his thoughts on this. I mean, maybe Jesse, perhaps you go first, and then good to get Steve and Cliff's view around what's going to happen next with the CFTC.
Yeah, I mean, who knows what Doge will come up with? But there's just too much water under that bridge. I just don't see a world where the CFTC and the SEC are combined. I think in part because, frankly, the SEC doesn't want to take on that role.
Right.
And it would be a massive undertaking for both agencies. And in some ways, you're kind of, the CFTC and the SEC are kind of friendly competitors in a way.
Yeah.
I think there's some danger in combining it into one, omnibus regulator.
Yeah. Yeah. I tend to agree with that. And in fact, it's I think more structural than that. If you've been around long enough, you also remember when Dodd-Frank, after the financial crisis, issue number one
at the top
of the list was got to combine the market regulators, the SEC and the CFTC, and it went nowhere. And I think that's a function also of just the Senate Banking Committee and the Senate Ag Committee. Nobody wants to give up regulatory turf. But it raises a good point, because the CFTC, so where do they fit in? I mean, if you think about it, we always talk about our tokens securities, but our crypto assets securities. But it's really like we need a coherent definition of what tokens are going to be regulated, who they're going to be regulated by, and what they do. I mean, it's kind of nuts that the SEC, bounds into one definition of what could be, a cryptocurrency, tokens, most common tokens out there, with a tokenized real world asset, like a security, like a bond,
or even
tokens that facilitate operational functionality, such as staking tokens. So this all has to be sorted out, and whether some of that is in the CFTC realm as, commodities, some of it's securities, some of it is something new. That's got to be job number one, whether through legislation or regulation.
And Steve, isn't it, just kind of comically absurd that the world we're in now, where Bitcoin and Ethereum are kind of viewed as not being securities, is simply through regulatory fiat, right? I mean, because, one of the things we encountered when we were trying to bring some Solana ETFs to the market is the SEC telling us, well, Solana is a security. And our response back to them was, well, you're going to have to explain to us how Ethereum isn't a security, but Solana is. And there just isn't any comprehensive logic to what's been done prior to now. And yeah, that's a huge part of the issue.
The direction that, the CFTC can take, I mean, if we look at them sort of as friendly competitors, but I think that to your point, Cliff, I mean, the evolution of these agencies, most likely in the future, it looks like everything's going to be moving in the technology neutral direction, right? So with SAB 122 gone, what are they telling us now? Well, apply GAAP, right? Go back to technology neutral and away from sort of discriminating against the technology. If you look on the CFTC side of the ledger, if you look at, acting chairman, Carolyn Pham, you know, who's acceded to the acting chairman role. But, you know, when you look at her, you know, GMAC subcommittee on digital assets, you know, the things that they've been putting out over the last few years, I mean, you know, ranging from a token classification framework that, you know, acknowledges the differences in different forms of digital assets, not looking at them monolithically as all securities like the SEC, you know, in prior times, you know, had a tendency to do, but instead kind of looking at them with their characteristics. And on the tokenization point, Paul, I mean, I think that, you know, the release of the, you know, from the GMAC saying that there is no reason in principle why non-cash collateral that is basically tracked on a distributed ledger or tokenized,
yeah,
as long as it's eligible margin to begin with, it doesn't matter what technological form that it's recorded in.
Right.
And whether that's blockchain technology or, you know, Microsoft Word or you know, sheets of paper, I mean, it's totally irrelevant, right? The question is it eligible margin or not? And I think you will see more of that evolution in a technology neutral direction going forward from both regulators. And I think that's very positive.
Okay. I mean, look, we've spoken a lot about the SEC and the CFTC, but let's just talk a bit more about the prudential and banking regulators who have been relatively radio silent, quite often taking a back seat on some of the digital asset debates. We've seen some high profile statements coming out the last week from some of the bank chiefs around how some of the banks might be more involved. You know, what are all the prudential supervisors saying? You know, what can we expect from them? Steve, I don't know, what are your views on that?
Sure. Well, you know, it's interesting. If you think back to the first Trump administration, it was some of the banking regulators, you know, what Brian Brooks comes to mind, that were at the kind of vanguard of thinking about how regulation should apply to these assets and, you know, establishing regimes around, you know, licensing. Unfortunately, when we had a change of administration, we had a change in attitude. And, you know, federal banking agencies back in 21 and 22 issued letters, you know, requiring banks to obtain, you know, approval or non-objection to engaging in crypto asset-related activities, which was very broadly defined. However, as we found with, you know, our clients and others, the requests for approval, you know, generally have gone unanswered. And it was, in effect, a de facto ban, which was nice. which was difficult. But, you know, given the executive order, given the statements from the newly confirmed Secretary of the Treasury or otherwise, we should see, you know, a thaw, a change in direction.
Okay. Well, we're going to see more discussion, I suspect, around risk weightings, the regulatory capital treatment, around, you know, how banks can hold this on balance sheets, et cetera. But what about the state level? I mean, what do you expect to see from different state sort of regulatory sort of policymakers? Any sort of views around that space? I don't know, Steve. You have any thoughts around the state?
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting that you haven't seen as much kind of development as you saw with you know, DFS, New York Department of Financial Services, putting in place a BIT licensing regime, certain states establishing certain charters that would facilitate, including a bank charter that would facilitate these you know, digital assets. But I think it's kind of a little bit of a wait and see at this point, as there's so much federal activity that's anticipated. I have not seen Jesse Cliff jump in. I haven't seen the states in a while.
Yeah, but particularly South Dakota, Wyoming, to those custody players. I don't know, Cliff, Jesse, if you're seeing anything there.
Yeah, I haven't. I mean, my inclination or my prediction here is that the states are probably in wait and see mode. To the extent that there's federal regulation that's going to be proposed, they would be preempted or they would be very limited in how they can regulate the space. And so my guess is they're waiting to see what that looks like before deciding what, if anything, they want to do.
will we get a, the question, you know, of any kind of comprehensive federal, you know, regulatory regime with respect to digital assets, and particularly one, you know, crafted, I think, by the GOP, which is historically, you know, party which has been sympathetic to sort of notions of states' rights and so on, you know, is I mean, to what extent will a comprehensive federal framework be one which devolves certain authority for the states or maintains recognition of, for example, the money transmitter, the non-bank money transmitter licensing framework, the BitLicense framework, which is digital asset specific? To what extent will they carve out a space for that sort of semi-prudential regulation, such prudential regulation as it is? It isn't really markets regulation, other than in the case of BitLicense and the California regime, which is in some ways BitLicense-like, and Louisiana has a BitLicense-like regime, and Wyoming now obviously has various dedicated, you know, digital asset-specific regulatory regimes as well, which are differentiated in various ways. But I think that the overarching question is, to what extent will the federal framework that we expect to come down the pike in the form of legislation, and of course the president's working group, you know, will provide essentially a blueprint, right, for what that legislation could look like, right? And you've got both of the markets regulators at the table, banking regulators not there, which could signal that they're a little bit disfavored due to, you know, choke point 2.0, some of the other things. But the question is, when they do carve up this regulatory turf, to what extent will there be a space preserved for the BitLicense type regimes and the money transmitter regime? And that space could be broader, I think, than some people realize. In other words, there could be more continuity than change is one possibility than the commentary, which is expecting a revolutionary turn, you know,
change. Some more devolution potentially, and more sort of complexity around different state by state sort of approaches. Okay, interesting. Well, let me just end the conversation there, and really just to invite anybody to reach out if you've got any questions. There will be a repeat of this call for our colleagues who are based in Asia, the different time zone. But otherwise, I'd like to thank you for joining us, and stay tuned, and we'll keep you updated on further developments. Thank you, everybody.